This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Earlier this month, the Royal Society of Canada released a report called Time to be Counted, COVID-19 and Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. The report detailed the problems people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have experienced during the pandemic and recommended some changes. Our accessibility reporter, Megan Gilmore, has combed through the reports and joins us now to tell us what it has to say. Hey, good morning, Megan.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, Megan, before we get into the details of this report, some news happened yesterday that relates to the recommendations in this report. So give us the update.
Sure. So this report makes several recommendations, and one of them is that the government, quote, develop a national disability income benefit sufficient enough to provide a reasonable minimum income for all Canadians with a disability. If you've been following our reporting for the past few months, that should not surprise you. So I was actually reading that section of the report. This is not a joke. I was reading that section of the report when I got the press release that yesterday Minister Carla Quattro, the Minister of Disability Inclusion and Workforce Development, did introduce legislation in the House of Commons that would enable the government to create a national disability benefit. And you probably remember that the national disability benefit is the cornerstone of the federal government's Disability Inclusion Action Plan that was announced last year. Before you all get too excited, this legislation doesn't say what the benefit will look like. So it doesn't say how much money people will get or what the relationship to provincial or territorial benefits will be.
Which are very important details.
Yes, very important. So those details, right now, it looks like this will be worked out in regulations. I'm hoping to get more information about this in the days to come. But just so we all know, legislation has been introduced to include this in tax legislation, and the government is still consulting on the Disability Action Inclusion Plan. As we reported earlier, that consultation ends on, or at least the online survey part of that consultation ends on August 31st.
Excellent. Okay, let's go back to this report. So the Royal Society of Canada. What specifically were they looking at?
So they were looking at how people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have been impacted by COVID. So first, the virus itself, and then the reactions to COVID. So how have lockdown measures, how have vaccination plans, how like hospital triage protocols, how have those responses impacted people with intellectual and developmental disabilities? And then as a result of that, they made several recommendations, 19, if you want to be specific. And there are two main groups of recommendations. Dave, you may appreciate this from some of our previous conversations. One group is essentially just including disability accessibility in already existing mainstream policies and government responses. So just making sure that what governments are already doing is disability inclusive. And then there were another set of policies that were disability specific policies. So policies that were catered specifically towards people with intellectual developmental disabilities. So for example, a general policy, like just including disability in the general policy framework, would be, you know, making sure that we prioritize persons of all ages who have intellectual and developmental disabilities in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccinations in Canada, along with other high-risk clinical groups, you know, in recognition of the complications and the fact that these individuals may be more at risk for the virus and more likely to be hospitalized or to die as a result of it. So that would be a general one. And then an example of a disability-specific policy would be to provide healthcare accommodations specifically for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities both during the pandemic and then in the post-pandemic recovery.
Mm-hmm. Megan, it might feel like I'm kind of picking at nits here, but there obviously is a bit of a difference here between recommendations and conclusions. So what were some of the conclusions that they came forward with the study?
Sure. So the main conclusion, the main way they did this study is they had several areas, and then they would first look at what was the experience of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities before the pandemic in regards to this specific area of focus, whether that be like leisure participation or inclusive education, employment. And then they would look at, okay, how has this been impacted by COVID? And generally, the conclusion will not surprise anyone who's been following along with this network for the last year. The conclusion was any problem has just been exacerbated.
Mm-hmm,
so COVID-19 did not necessarily create new problems, while the vaccine is the virus and then the vaccine rollout, those are very specific new things. The overall general concerns were already existing, and they've just kind of adapted and changed during the pandemic.
Megan, in that last answer, you mentioned an area like leisure activity, which, again, when we're talking about some of the bigger picture stuff, like financial supports, hospitalization, healthcare, sometimes that falls under the radar, but it's a really important one. So how did restrictions on leisure activities impact people at a practical level?
Well, they still are impacting people depending on what jurisdiction you're in and what services you use. So I was speaking to David Cron, who is a spokesperson for Barrier Free Manitoba, which is an organization that advocates for increased accessibility and would monitor things like the Accessibility for Manitobans Act. And in his experience, what they've seen is that there's, quote, which is a mishmash of policies throughout that province. There's still certain programs that are just not being offered right now. There's some programs that have never been offered during COVID. They just kind of stopped. But it depends on where you are and what services you use. And then that leads to a lot of frustration for people and a lot of burnout in terms of friends or family who may be filling in the gaps, and a lot of frustration for the people who use these programs. David would talk about how leisure activities that are scheduled are kind of, to the people who use them, they're kind of like they're going to work, and it's like if your job was suddenly just not available for 15-16 months, how would that make somebody feel? But there it is a mishmash, as he would say. There's been lots of differences throughout, and that theme of different types of policies or inconsistencies can be seen in many areas during this pandemic, whether that's visitation policies or government supports and how CERB is treated in terms of receiving other disability support.
Right. So we touched on this right off the top, the financial component and some of the updates in regard to this. But what were some of the conclusions that were drawn in the report in regards to some of the financial disparities that exist in regards to supports, both during the pandemic and generally speaking?
Sure. So some of it will not surprise anybody who was listening to our show, Dave. I was like, were they just hanging out with Dave and I? So there's this lengthy section that explained in very good, concise detail about how CERB, which is $2,000 a month, just showed how inadequate provincial and territorial disability supports are. And there was this great chart that broke down how different jurisdictions in Canada treated CERB in terms of clawback, and did the math about how much CERB you could actually receive if you were still receiving disability or territorial supports, and how much of your disability and territorial supports, provincial territorial disability supports you would receive if you were receiving CERB. So that was great. It was kind of like a recap of work you and I had already done. So I was excited. But then they also talked about the other government responses. So, for example, there's a caregiving benefit if you had to take time off work to care for somebody during the COVID-19 pandemic. Great. But that benefit only applies to people who had jobs and then took time off work during the pandemic to be a caregiver. If, and this is the case for several families, if I have a family member with a disability and, you know, near the beginning of our journey with their disability, we decide that I'm going to stay home to care for my child. So I don't even enter the workforce. I'm just at home providing care full time, I'm not eligible for a caregiving benefit because I wasn't working. So the caregiving benefit is really only for working people who then also did caregiving. It wasn't for people who have made caregiving their main activity and their main way of contributing to their families.
Right, who might have already retired early or made whatever choice they wanted to become a primary caregiver in their family. Yeah, it definitely speaks to, again, the perpetual gaps and cracks that we've identified over and over and over again over the course of the last 14 months. Megan, anything in the report surprise you?
Sure. Well, first I was actually kind of, it was kind of validating to see so many themes in there that we had already discussed. So I don't know if Dave Brown Consulting wants to, you know, connect with all these researchers. Because of what I've been doing for the last year, I really just expect everybody to say, it's all terrible. It's always been awful. It will always be that way, like ER or Winnie the Pooh. And I was surprised, but grateful to hear people talk about how something like telehealth, so our movement in the past year to provide more healthcare services virtually, in some cases, that actually can be beneficial for people with disabilities. And especially if you are looking for a very specialized type of care or health professional, and they are not geographically close to you. You'd have to go a far, far distance to get that type of care. There are some services that can be better provided for some individuals over telehealth. Obviously, there are a lot of restrictions and limitations on that. For example, if you're helping somebody with physiotherapy, that can be somewhat challenging to do that virtually. But it was nice to hear that there are some people who've actually received care that they would not have normally received because of innovations in healthcare delivery that we've done over the past 14 months or so.
Yeah, it's we know it's been a difficult year, but there certainly have been a few positives to come out of it for sure. Hey, Megan, thank you for making time to be with us today. Thank you for scouring this report, and we'll talk to you again I won't talk to you on Friday for the news panel. Mike Ross will talk to you on Friday for the news panel.
Right. He will. Enjoy the rest of your week, Dave.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.